For Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. Our next guest on the show is Will Grigg from one of the greatest blogs on the whole World Wide Web. It's called Pro Libertate. It's at Freedom in Our Time. blogspot.com. You can also find him regularly at lourockwell.com/blog. Welcome back to the show, Will.
Scott, thanks for having me on again. It's always a pleasure.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us on the show today, and I want to apologize for leaving you on hold, but I wanted to play that whole song there.
Because
I just had this great conversation with this lady, Elaine Brower, whose son was a Marine and went and fought in two bogus wars and, you know, very easily could have been one of the ones killed over there. And it occurred to me that, her whole thing about they never show us pictures of these wars and all that, that's important. But,
yeah.
You know, most Americans were brought up to, even if there's a plane crash somewhere, right, they go, 300 people died, including 12 Americans. You know,
mm-hmm.
like, we're, Americans are the Ubermen, we're different, we're special, whatever, so never mind. You know, when they talk about how many people died in Iraq, they go, over 4,000 people have died, referring to the American soldiers who died over there. And I'm just thinking, man, it's really not fair of us, the civilians, in this supposedly democratic society, to keep sending these kids over there to die for nothing. This is not just make-believe. It's not just Scott Horton's hobby horse and this and that. It's like this thing I read by Pat Tillman's brother when he's saying, oh, yeah, thanks a lot for the care package. That means a lot to me when my skin is melting to the seat of my aluminum Humvee and I'm being tossed 50 feet in the air by a homemade landmine on the side of the road. Get me out of here. What the hell is going on? How can we? It's 2010, and we're just going to let this go forever, I guess.
Apparently so, and I think that there are a couple of points that could be fleshed out here from what you said. The first of which is this really unfortunate but persistent ethnocentricity where we assume that any group of people targeted by our government because of conflicts with the government ruling those people just don't count. They just sort of fade into the background, and we only focus on the deaths and injuries which are afflicting those who are being sent there at the behest of our government to kill people who have neither injured nor threatened us in any way. And that's a terrible part of the equation, and that's one that I wish the people who profess to be Christians in particular would take into account when they're formulating opinions about this war. The second and most important part to most people deals with the impact that this war has on those sent to fight, which is to say to occupy and push people around in other countries, and the fact that even those who come back without being maimed or physically mangled in some way, often come back from that experience changed in ways that make them very difficult to deal with in terms of trying to readjust to some semblance of a normal life. They're injured in ways that go right to the core of what biblical believers refer to as the soul, the psyche. And these people will come back, many of them, and take positions in law enforcement. And even if they don't take positions in law enforcement, chances are they're going to come back and they're going to have responsibilities for which they may not be immediately suited, given their experiences in this war. And I can't help but think that one element of the psychology here has to do with the fact that many of these people, who are fundamentally decent in many ways, irrespective of what they're being tasked to do in this grand decency, know that they have no business being over there and doing what they're doing. I call that the avatar syndrome. People go into a country like Iraq or Afghanistan and find themselves asking, how would I feel if I were on the receiving end of this errand of supposed armed benevolence? And that really has to screw people up terribly. I simply can't imagine being put into that position myself. I certainly don't want any of my four sons to end up in that position either. But unless people do something assertive to stop what's going on, this is going to claim a generation. Think of that for a second. We're going to talk about what Condoleezza Rice and his eminent darkness, Darth Cheney, used to refer to as a generational conflict. They weren't kidding, as it turns out.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing, too, is, Americans are screwed up anywhere, and they're dumber than hell. And this is just corrupting what's left of, you know, any of the thing. I'm sorry, I'm on my hobby horse on the show today.
That's your prerogative.
But, you know, the thing is, I read something that George Will wrote years and years ago that I thought, I agree with this. Mm-hmm. And it's that what makes you an American is that you assent to the principles of the Declaration of Independence. That's it.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it doesn't matter where you're from, what you believe in, where you work, what you own, how rich you are, whatever. The point is that we all believe that it's self-evident, can't prove it, and don't care. I got a musket. How do you like that? Self-evident that we're all born free and that we all respect each other being born free, and that if we are going to do something so heinous as, say, lock a free man in a cage, we're going to give him a fair trial first. You know, little stuff like that. I mean, even when I was a kid in the Cold War, it was, you know, peacetime was the norm, and if we went to war, there was a war, and then, you know, presumably it was over. Even Vietnam, which went on and on and on,
yeah,
was considered an exception to the norm, which was America at peace. And yet, as you said, this generational conflict, it is on. The Pentagon is, they're leading the policy, Will, and they're not backing down.
No,
I was
not
talking to Eric Margolies on the show the other day, and he was saying, look at them. They're just expanding all into Arabia, into Africa. The generational conflict absolutely is going on. And meanwhile, it's turning us into a society of torturers. It's turning us into a society of people who no longer believe that a man should get a trial before he goes and gets locked in a cage. And it's turning us into a society, as you say, these young men shell-shocked by the fact they've been betrayed. It's turned us into a society of betrayers.
Yeah, and it's metastasizing into the very bone, the very marrow of our society in ways that people are only beginning now to appreciate, and it's entirely predictable. With respect to what you're talking about concerning the Pentagon driving the policy right now, I think it was Andrew Bacevich who pointed out that you've got a military that is largely autonomous right now, and that's a logical outgrowth of the national security state that was created back in roughly 1947 and 1948 that came to define all of our domestic institutions. Many of these generals are more like proconsuls. They are as functionally autonomous as starship captains on Star Trek. They're not. It's not because they're out of touch with Starfleet Command. It's not because they're light years away and they're only able to contact Starfleet Command for instructions by way of subspace radio. These people have nearly instantaneous communication with civilian political authority, but civilian political authority has been reconfigured by the national security state to the point where we just assume that the most important function of the president is as commander-in-chief. People who are civilians who have had no experience in the military or no employment in the government in any way, much less in the executive branch, routinely refer to the president as commander-in-chief, which is not only a solecism, I think it's an abomination. But furthermore, you've got a situation now where, just as of yesterday, the incumbent commander-in-chief now is rolling out a program of synchronization with the executive branch officers of the various states, which now administrative divisions of the central government. They used to be autonomous states. Now they're just administrative elements of the Leviathan, the centralized Leviathan. He wants to put together a council of governors to the point of synchronizing military policy for both domestic and foreign purposes. Domestic, of course, would include disasters and what's called homeland security concerns. But this represents a really important element of this whole architecture of a leader state, or Führerprinzip, to use the German expression. And for synchronization, you could use the old Nazi expression Gleichschaltung, or coordination. It refers to the idea that everything has to be harmonized or coordinated through the executive branch, through the supreme leader's office, and eventually subsume every function of government into the executive branch. And in the Nazi scheme, you ended up making it all subordinate to the National Socialist Party. We don't really have one ruling party right now as such. We have sort of a cartel between the Democrats and the Republicans, who are functionally one party. But the point is, they're creating this bipartisan apparatus of coordination for military affairs that would circumvent Congress. It's completely spurious from a constitutional perspective. It's operated through the executive branch and through a panel of 10 chief executives from states. And since 2006, the so-called National Guard, which started out as the select militia of the various states, was basically turned into a presidential Praetorian Guard. And the function of this council now is to coordinate policy with respect to, among other things, the domestic use of the National Guard. And as I pointed out in the blog item that was posted on LewRockwell.com's blog this morning, this really does savor of the old National Socialist approach to coordination or synchronization of Gleichschaltung. Everything is being coordinated, put on the same set of rails. And this is the sort of thing that James Madison had in mind when he warned way back in the early 1790s that of all the enemies of peace and all the enemies of liberty, war is the most to be dreaded. Because eventually, if you nurture it long enough and let it grow roots and flourish, you end up with a completely militarized state. That's where we're headed right now. It doesn't seem that way to most people because there's still this lingering illusion of consumer prosperity in the land. But once that illusion dissipates like a desert mirage, what's going to be left is the fully functioning infrastructure of a militarized presidential leader state.
Well, and you know, it reminds me too, and you're absolutely right about the James Madison quote. And in fact, as you well know, he was far from alone. Mm-hmm. These men that assembled the war power turned around and said, by the way, you guys don't want to let us use this very much or else
exactly.
Things are going to get really bad for you.
Even Alexander Hamilton was of that persuasion.
Right. Yeah, even Hamilton, right? But so it also reminds me of the great pamphlet, The People's Pottage. It's actually three pamphlets.
Yeah.
It's been republished as Ex-America by, is it Garrett Garrett? You pronounce them both
Garrett.
The same, even though, they are pronounced different and spelled there. Garrett Garrett. There you go. So Will Grigg, he's the guy who knows. and let's see. It's The Revolution Was Ex-America and Rise of Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And in Rise of Empire, and this is written 60 years ago, right?
I know.
And then in Rise of Empire, he says, you know, this is what happens when you have all these foreign obligations, is that the national government and, of course, the presidency become ascendant. And what we're really talking about here in 2010, what you're talking about with all this synchronization, this is really... you know, where the empire comes home, we get a very top-down Pentagon-like structure for our own society.
Yeah.
Where if, as we could have made the same joke 10 years ago too, I guess, but if any of the founding fathers were here and looked at this society, this government, and said, and we told them we still have the same constitution from 1789, and we've only amended it 27 times or whatever, they would laugh in our face and say, no, in fact, you don't. And this goes to the core of American ignorance, is that people don't even know what federalism means. People don't even understand the structure of the separate powers under the Constitution to realize how far we've come from that. I mean, obviously the Civil War was a long time ago and all that, but we're really getting to the point where the states are, maybe we're past the point where the states are but large counties under the control of the single United State of America.
I think that's a very good assessment of what's going on, unfortunately. We do have our Constitution in the sense that it's been preserved in amber like a prehistoric insect. It doesn't have any relevance to what the government does, apart from being invoked routinely as part of the ritual of self-ratification as whoever happens to be occupying the Oval Office pronounces a policy the rest of us are supposed to support and uphold and pay for, more importantly. And thanks, of course, to the nefarious Federal Reserve, the Congress doesn't even have to authorize taxes, direct taxes, in order to pay the expenditures of empire, whether the domestic or the foreign realm is being looked at as an arena for policy. All you have to do is write the measure into what they're pleased to call law and then take out the credit card and have the Federal Reserve exhalate whatever amount of money is required in order to carry out that initiative. And since 2008 in particular, when the TARP went through and suddenly the Federal Reserve and Treasury Department formed their own little financial and economic cartel that cut Congress almost entirely out of the process of controlling the purse strings, you actually have sort of a triumvirate in practice where the Federal Reserve chief is the guy who's in charge of the money supply. He's the guy basically who holds the public purse. The Treasury Secretary is an economic dictator who decides who gets the disbursements out of the public purse. And then the president's in charge of coercion and enforcement. And that's really sort of where Rome was at after Sulla and after the Civil War of the late first century before Christ. They still had the residual forms of a Senate and a Constitution. That's something Garrett pointed out. There's been a revolution within the form. He saw this, as you pointed out, in 1950 or earlier, but he saw this all in principle. We're living today under the outcome of what Garrett saw being planted and cultivated way back in 1950. He saw how the national security state basically was a repudiation of that which made America distinctive. This idea that we were a commercial republic, that we had limited ambitions in the world, would maintain a navy to protect ourselves from foreign invasion, and also, when necessary, to come to the aid of Americans doing business overseas who might fall into the hands of wrongdoers, evildoers. But we didn't have the military as the defining institution of the government, much less the defining institution of society. You go to any football game, go to any of these bread and circuses type distractions of any sizable impact, the military is an omnipresent element. It's ubiquitous. And they're out trolling for people everywhere.
Well, and Will, you know, there's a great piece by Mark Ames at Alternet, where he was talking about the kind of postal nature of the Fort Hood shooting. It was all spun as a jihadist thing, but it apparently had a lot more to do with the pressure the guy was under. At least that was Ames' point. But one of the things he cited in there was a poll where I think you and I would kind of smile at the fact that a very small percentage of the American people answer in the affirmative when asked, do they trust the national government, the U.S. government, to do the right thing most of the time, or I forget exactly how it was phrased, but basically, you know, one of those questions. But 71% trust the Pentagon. And this really cuts to what you say when all this falls apart, when the dollar's worth a dime, and everything, when the law is gone away, all we have left is General Petraeus. That's all that the American people believe in anymore. You talk about all the bread and circus and all the airplanes flying overhead at the football games and whatever. It's accomplished its purpose. I mean, the government is the best of us, and the military is the best of them.
Yeah, very much the case.
It's all we have left, Will, war.
I've mentioned before.
Even against ourselves, that's all we have.
Exactly. Now, I mentioned before, way back in, I think it was 1992, in Parameters, which is published by, if I remember correctly, the Special Forces School there at Fort Bragg, there was an essay entitled The Origins of the Military Coup of 2012. And one of the points made in this precautionary tale was the fact that by the early second decade of the 21st century, as foretold by this military strategist, you'd have a situation where every institution of public life had been thoroughly discredited except for the military. And at that point, when we were in the middle of a foreign crisis involving Iran and a fully orbed economic collapse here at home, the military would descend or ascend, depending upon your perspective, into outright martial control of American society. It's sort of like a footnote or a sequel to Robert Heinlein's original novel, The Starship Troopers, where he projected basically the same thing happening. And in order to be a citizen, you would have to do national service, or what they called federal service.
Right.
And this is the same type of a scenario that was portrayed in this Parameters essay from back in the early 1990s by somebody who was working within the system who did not want to see this come about. And you can see how the lineaments of that system are visible and being strengthened right now by every policy decision being made by the supposedly peace-loving, supposedly liberal, progressive, internationalist president, who's basically a more charismatic, more personable, and more articulate version of his predecessor in every relevant way.
Yeah, well, and this cuts right to the heart of what the previous guest was talking about, too, which is the state of the economy and how, as people are forced out of work, basically there's nothing left except to go and work for the state. I'm sure you saw where the Washington, D.C. economy is doing great at the expense of everything else. And, you know, this is also part of, and I'm always grateful I can talk with you, another guy who understands the business cycle. And this is part of even the 30-year bubble or the 60-year post-World War II bubble, where we've been able to export inflation to the world this whole time. And we have deindustrialized our economy where, you know, our massive port cities, cities like, Baltimore, Maryland, or places that were, huge trading posts like St. Louis, the automakers in Detroit, where everything is just gone, Will. There ain't nothing left except war here.
Yeah, and they're cratered moonscapes, they're urban moonscapes, as desolate as the lunar regolith when it comes to productive activity. And instead of having people who are out manufacturing things or doing honest commerce, what takes precedence? Basically, you've got people who are being scooped up by military recruiters. You've got police who are acting like highwaymen or what they used to call road agents, just laying in wait for people to confiscate their property in the name of asset forfeiture, and then just to bank the proceeds without charging people with a crime. That's a big business right now in Detroit, perhaps the only big business there. And this is the sort of thing, really, that is an augury of that same dismal future that was predicted by Heinlein and predicted by, I believe, I can't remember which the name of the contributor to Parameters who talked about the military coup 2012, but you can see it happening right now in real time. And it's the sort of thing that's not irreversible. It would occasion a little bit of pain to reverse course right now, but the thing is, we're going to reverse course. Those things that cannot be sustained, those things that are unsustainable, will not be sustained much longer, and this is not sustainable.
Yeah, well, it's like that movie where they all crash in the mountains and they start eating each other, man. I mean, I may have mentioned this to you before. I'm sure you probably got a hold of Charles Goyette's book, The Dollar Meltdown.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful book.
And he says in there that, I forgot his original analogy, so I'll use mine as, or the metaphor is the goose that laid the golden egg. That's what the American people, you know, if you're a government parasite, or even a banker, a private parasite, some kind of military industrial complex sort of guy, we would at least hope that they see us as the goose that laid the golden egg, the productive people who continue to produce wealth for them to suck off of.
Yeah.
But Goyette says, no, man, those days are over.
Mm-hmm.
This is like As We Go Marching or whatever. It's already too late. The revolution was. It already happened. And so now America is no longer the goose that laid the golden egg. Now we are a piñata. And it's a piñata party, and it's a race for whoever can get the stick of the state to try to swing at it and get as much out of the American carcass, the American productive capacity, until there's just nothing left but a carcass,
yeah.
I guess is what I mean to say there.
Yeah.
And, so empire as cannibalism, you know, that's the way I'm looking at this more and more. Like,
yep.
The people, and you know, here's the funny thing about it. Aren't the establishment of America, aren't they Americans? I mean, don't they have to live here? Don't they take pride that their families came, you know, back before the revolution on the Mayflower or whatever the hell? Whatever happened to the evil conspiracy that controls America? Don't they want to at least preserve themselves and the base of all their wealth?
I think
maybe this is why all empires fall, because it just gets out of control.
Exactly. It metastasizes. You end up with a situation where, as you say, if a revolution reaches what's called the Saturn phase, where it eats its young, every empire eventually turns into an exercise in cannibalism. And I think that the people you're describing, the power elite, are Americans, in many instances, by birth or by naturalization, but not by conviction, because somebody who's an American is somebody who embraces the tenets of the Declaration of Independence. Nobody who does so could possibly manage things the way these people are. So I don't think that they are motivated by anything other than simple calculations of self-interest and self-preservation, and quite frankly, they have mobility that the rest of us don't enjoy. Those of us who wanted to go wouldn't be able to flee with our capital. There are going to be capital controls slapped on this economy. Watch, I bet that before the end of the first term, assuming that there's more than one term, or assuming that there's an election in 2012, we're probably going to hear serious discussions of preventing capital flight. That's right out of the Communist Manifesto. You want to confiscate the assets of immigrants and rebels. And we're already seeing border enforcement protocols right now that could be turned inward as well as turned outward to prevent people from leaving as well as to prevent people from coming in. And I suspect that the Dick Cheneys of the world, who've been setting up offshore accounts and investing overseas and business facilities in Dubai and elsewhere, would be able to find some safe haven abroad while America collapses into an economic singularity. That's a very real possibility.
Collapses into an economic singularity. Well, you always have such a way with words, Will Gregg, I gotta tell you. So listen, let me try to tap some wisdom here that I know you got something to say. What are we supposed to do about it? What's the audience supposed to do about it? You know, they are the people who sit around and read antiwar.com, this audience, right? It's not like it's a broad one. It's a very narrow audience. These are people who want to do something about it. What do they do other than blogging? What do they do other than, you know, Is it worth it to try to run for Congress? Should they just go around and try to spread,
you know,
ideals of anarchism everywhere they go? Or what do we do, man? Everybody's, I think, feeling like their back's up against the wall here, man.
Yeah.
Getting to.
One of the things I quite enjoy whenever I'm under the sad necessity of visiting some kind of a government depot or some kind of a government office to be involved in some function. For instance, I had to take my lovely wife, Corinne, to traffic court a couple of weeks ago. I do my best to sow disaffection and sedition whenever I find myself in that circumstance. And it's amazing there are a lot of people who are receptive. The thing that I find is that dealing with my conservative relatives, which is to say on either side of the family, dealing with my relatives, it's a little bit easier now if you make Obama the target of the criticism to get them thinking in terms of what the government does to you as opposed to what the government supposedly does for you. This is a window of opportunity for those who have conservative relatives to get them thinking in terms of that sort. Disabusing them of the notion that the military and the police are somehow superior to the Internal Revenue Service and the welfare state bureaucracies they abhor, that's a little bit steeper challenge, but I found that if you lay the groundwork carefully, you can help persuade people in that respect. And persuading people, trying to reconquer the territory between the ears of human beings, is one of the most important things we can do. That means we have to go outside of our comfort zone. I was much more comfortable in the presence of conservatives, conventional conservatives, 10 or 15 years ago than I am now, ironically enough. It would have been transgressing my personal comfort zone to be talking to the so-called peace creeps, to use a P.G. O'Rourke's expression. Whereas by 2000 or so, I was very much comfortable in the presence of people, candlelight vigils against war and things of that sort. So people can change is what I'm saying. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with running sort of a quixotic campaign for Congress or any other public office as a way of getting people talking. But in terms of practical preparations as well, it's important to recognize that we're entering a period of severe economic turmoil in which just maintaining the necessities of life is going to be a very big challenge. And so while we have time, and if you have assets suitable to that task, it's a good idea to be emulating some of the behavior that we see on the part of the much derided survivalists, or from the perspective of many survivalists, the much derided illegal immigrants. How do these people survive in an underground economy? That's something worth studying and worth emulating. There's a variation of that thought that I saw put into motion in Maricopa County. The Mussolini of Maricopa County, Joe Arpaio, has been the target of a federal inquiry, and I don't think it's going to go anywhere. But a lot of people who support the rights of those who come here to this country without government permission, a.k.a. illegal immigrants, have been creating text trees to warn people about police sweeps, pretext sweeps, that end up locking up brown people who listen to Mexican radio stations and such like. It doesn't matter whether they're illegal immigrants or legal immigrants, legal residents, or citizens of Mexican extraction. They all get scooped up in this dragnet, that's laid out by the Maricopa County Sheriff's Department. But they have text trees that work very well for that purpose, and that's something a lot of people who don't necessarily focus on that issue could emulate as well, in terms of trying to provide defense and depth in the event that things take a really scary turn in this country. And that type of a turn is a very palpable possibility right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to complain a little here, too, and give you a chance as well, if you want to chime in, about the opportunity costs here. And knowing your nature, well, I would guess you're probably not too big a fan of the Family Guy. Am I right?
No, it's not.
Not quite your taste. All right. Well, anyway, I'm going to tell you this story anyway, because it's funny.
Okay.
Their season premiere this year had them doing the show Sliders, basically, where they're going, they have a little gizmo, and they're going from dimension to dimension.
I saw part of that.
Oh, really? Yeah, there you go, where they were all drawn as Disney characters and all that.
Yeah, that, cool. That part was hysterical.
Yeah.
Bitter and brutal and dark, but hysterical.
Okay, so, yeah, that was, it was pretty crazy. But then again, Walt Disney was a Nazi.
Well, yeah.
So, here's the thing, though. Did you see the one where they go and everything looks like the Jetsons? Everything's really clean and everything looks super modern. Everybody has flying Jetson boots and it's all very futuristic looking. Did you see that one?
I saw part of that, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And so then the explanation for it was, in this reality, nobody ever invented religion. So all the religion-based conflict for the last 2,000 years or 5,000 years or 10,000 or whatever never happened. But it seemed to me like the obvious punchline there was, in this reality, Woodrow Wilson never got America into World War One, and so it ended as a stalemate. There never was a Soviet Union. There never was a Nazi Germany. There never was a World War Two or a Cold War. And so all the productive wealth of people went to cool things like Jetson's boots. And you would only really have to redo the 20th century. And in fact, it got me thinking about, what if we only had the chance to redo the 21st so far? Yeah, what if Harry Brown had been the president and had started and ended the war on terrorism in a week and a half and told the American people, be cool, it's all right, gone through the recession that we needed to after the bubble of the dot-com madness, mm-hmm. and had spent this time building a real productive economy and real wealth and working in as many ways as possible toward guaranteeing more liberty and better protections of their liberties for all Americans. Just think what a different world this would be if it was only just the last 10 years redone the right way. You know?
I know. That tore me. Thoughts of that sort do torment me in terms of what you properly described as opportunity cost. If Woodrow Wilson's presidency hadn't occurred, if we'd been spared the Federal Reserve and World War One and all the ensuing horrors that were breathed out by the hellmouth that was the murder-suicide of the Christian West, commonly called World War One, we'd be colonizing Alpha Centauri by now, for heaven's sake. I really don't see how, if we had, how we could have avoided that type of quantum improvement in the aggregate human condition as a result of devoting our energies to the production of things that are worthwhile and the emancipation of the human potential for devising ways of increasing our quality of life. I honestly don't think that we could have been restrained from doing things of that sort if we hadn't been involved in fits of self-slaughter of that kind. And that's one of the things that, once again, make me shake my head in bitter wonderment. I did see that episode, that part of the episode. I didn't see the whole thing of the Family Guy, and I had the same thought. I said there's one religion in particular that is responsible for the present state of affairs that we all lament, and that's the religion of statism. It is the worship of collective human powers focused through this engine of misery we call government. And if somehow that religion had been conquered in, say, 1910, rather than spawning a whole planet encompassing series of religious wars among the various factions of that faith, there's just no telling where humanity would be right now. And that's, as I said, a thought that's the source of some anguish for me.
Well, Greg, you're the best blogger on the internet, man.
Oh, that's very kind. Thank you so much.
And you're pretty good out loud, too. Everybody, that's William Norman Grigg. He keeps the blog Pro Libertate at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And you can also find him at lourockwell.com/blog, where, I'm sorry we didn't get too far into the actual details of this synchronization.
Right.
But you can all go to the Lou Rockwell blog and look at the details here as we go marching. Thanks, Will.
Thanks. You take care.
You too.